And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
And you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, positive talk radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is leaders. Each of my guests is discussing leadership or a leader in a particular field. My next guest teaches leadership to organizations. He developed his theory of connectedness out of his own experience and relates it to business success in his book titled The Connection Culture. And if you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Michael Lee Stollard is president of the leadership training and coaching firm E Pluribus Partners. He founded E Pluribus Partners back in 2002. Michael helps leaders engage employees to boost productivity, innovation, and organizational performance. Prior to founding E Pluribus Partners, Michael was the chief marketing officer for the private wealth management business of Morgan Stanley and Charles Schwab. Earlier in his career, he worked as an investment banker at Barclays and the marketing and financial management positions at Texas Instruments. Michael is the primary author of the best-selling book, Fired Up or Burned Out, How to Reignite Your Team's Passions, Creativity, and Productivity, and is a regular contributor to leadership periodicals worldwide. Michael is also a guest lecturer at the Darden Graduate School of Business at the University of Virginia. Go Wahoos. Welcome to the show, Mike. How are you today?
I am doing great. Thanks, Billy.
Well, thank you for being our guest. I did love your book, and it's interesting to me right off the bat. You left Wall Street about 9 years ago, almost to this month, to research and write a book on leadership. About the same time, however, you had an incident in your personal life that really crystallized the idea of connection for you. So tell us the relationship between your wife Katie's cancer diagnosis and developing your theory of connection.
Sure. I'll tell you, that was a complete surprise. I had left Wall Street because I had seen that mergers weren't working because of cultures, and I also felt I had seen a lot of cultures on Wall Street headed in the wrong direction, and I felt I needed to do something about it. So I left, and I wanted to focus on it full-time, do some research, and really line up my arguments. And I kept seeing this, the importance of that most organizations were focused on task excellence, Billy, but the leaders weren't investing sufficient time to develop relationship excellence. And it was the failure of relationships that spilled over and sabotaged tasks and performance in organizations. And so this whole idea of relationships and connection, you know, do we feel like a team? Do we feel like a partnership, a company? Or do we feel like outsiders? Really has an impact on the effort that people put in their work and whether or not they align their behavior with the leadership's goals for the organization. And so I was doing all that research, and then in 2003, my wife, Katie, was diagnosed with breast cancer. Fortunately, it was caught early, and she was treated. But about a year later, when they were testing her on a quarterly basis, you know, just being concerned about possibility of recurrence, mm-hmm. then they identified that she had advanced ovarian cancer. And I should say this right now, that Katie just celebrated her 7th year of being cancer-free.
Oh, that is
good.
And
her doctors at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center have told us that they believe she will not have a recurrence.
That is good news. I'm glad to hear that, Mike. Yeah, that is good news. But the experience at Sloan Kettering was really instrumental in crystallizing this theory for you. So tell us, what happened to you at Sloan Kettering while you're going through this traumatic personal turmoil? What was it about Sloan Kettering that really stood out in your experience?
Well, let me just describe this, and hopefully you and your listeners can picture what this might have looked like. Katie had had 6 rounds of chemotherapy the spring of 2004, and then she took the summer off. And then we knew we needed to be aggressive, so we signed her up for what's called second look surgery at Sloan Kettering and additional rounds of chemo. And I remember our first visit to the gynecological oncology group at Sloan Kettering. And we're walking down 53rd Street in Manhattan. And as we get close, we're approaching the entrance to Sloan Kettering. And there's this big doorman who locks his eyes on Katie. He's a dark-complected guy with striking blue eyes. And he's locking his eyes and greeting Katie like a returning friend. This is highly unusual in Manhattan. People don't make eye contact.
That's true.
And, you know, he's just a real gregarious guy, very friendly. Nick is his name. And we learned later that Nick was a cancer survivor himself and attributed his survival to the treatment he received at Sloan Kettering. So, you know, we just felt like the healing began within eyesight of the place because of this guy who was reaching out and connecting with people who he recognized were cancer patients because they were wearing wigs.
Mm.
And then we entered into the reception area, and the receptionist was calling us honey, and as you might guess, that was also highly unusual in Manhattan that that would happen.
Yes.
And the security people were friendly, the administrative people were friendly. When we met with our oncologist, Dr. Marty Hensley, she spent an hour with us. She was upbeat and optimistic, and we just felt this sense of connection with her. And I had two distinct reactions that day, Billy. The first was, I had done my research, and I knew that this was one of the best teams in the world to treat the type of cancer that Katie had. But I had a second reaction that really surprised me. I knew that they cared, because I could feel it. And you know, Billy, that feeling I had, it just made me more optimistic that we could get Katie through the tough season ahead. And indeed, that's what happened. Katie is one of the rare people who has survived advanced ovarian cancer and breast cancer. So
it's a moving
totally
story.
Lined up with my research. It really helped me connect the dots on the research, because when you look at just the power of connection in our lives, say, for example, infants who feel connected to their caregivers, their mothers in particular, they have a mental and physical health advantage that lasts all their lives. Students who feel connected to their teachers perform better academically. Teenagers who feel connected to their parents or their friends are less likely to get in trouble. Adults who feel connected are more creative, they're better problem solvers. Seniors who feel connected are less likely to get sick. If they get sick, they recover faster and they live longer. So this feeling of connection that we experience in life has a huge impact on our performance and also the joy and contentment that we experience in life. And no surprise, because it affects our performance. It also affects the performance. It affects the performance of organizations. So it is essential for leaders to understand how to cultivate cultures that increase connection and ultimately boost performance.
We're talking to Mike Lee Stollard. That's a very moving story, Mike. So let's dive into your research. And what are the core elements of connective culture that meet our basic human needs? You've defined them for us very well. What are those core elements?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, we have this formula: task excellence plus relationship excellence equals sustainable superior performance. And it's a connection culture that produces relationship excellence. The connection culture is based on three core elements. We have some additional elements, but we probably only have time for three. And we simply call them vision, value, and voice. And vision exists when everyone in the organization is, number one, motivated by the mission. They feel they're united by the values of the organization, and they're proud of the reputation. And one of my favorite examples is Steve Jobs. You know, Apple is it's the most respected company in the world. It's been it's received that award from Fortune magazine for the fourth year in a row. It also has the number one brand in the world. And if you know the story, Jobs and Steve Wozniak founded Apple. They eventually took it public, and the board felt that it had outgrown Jobs' competence as a CEO, and so he was removed from that position, and he left, and he started Next Computer, but the outsider they brought in really didn't take Apple to the next level. So they bought Next from Jobs and brought him in. He became the CEO, and when he came back, he recognized, Billy, that Apple had lost its way. The people there were starting to think of themselves as technologists and computer makers rather than how Steve viewed them. So what Jobs did is he teamed up with an advertising agency. They created this very famous campaign called Think Different, if you remember those ads.
I sure do.
And his argument was this, that because we have an easy-to-use graphical user interface, we are truly changing the world. We're making the power of computers available to people who are not engineers, who are perhaps even intimidated by technology, and we're making it easy to use. And by doing so, we are going to change the world and empower these individuals to just take their creative works to new heights. And boy, did he connect with audiences. In fact, it was interesting. There was a writer in the audience when they rolled out the first ad to the Apple employees, and the writer was watching Jobs and just said, when they rolled out the first commercial, there were tears streaming down Steve Jobs' face.
He
was so moved by that ad and what it represented. His heart is really in, he really believes in the Apple cause, and people know that his heart's in it. Now, he's on the second element, we're going to talk about human value, or just simply value. Do people feel valued in the culture? Jobs, that's an area that he's not as strong at.
Not as his strong suit.
Apple culture who are.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, Mike. That's right. It's not his strong suit. But before we leave the whole issue of vision, we're talking to Mike Stollard, everyone. Tell me the other story that really exemplifies vision, and that goes all the way back to World War II, pre-computers, pre-technology, with FDR's visit to the Boeing plant out here on the West Coast during World War II with a young pilot.
Oh, Billy, that's one of my favorite stories. I get shivers down my spine when I think about this. Yeah, FDR was really brilliant at this element of vision and helping people see the big picture and motivating them, connecting with them emotionally so they want to give their best efforts. And this was at a time when, for you historians, you'll remember General George Marshall, who was the Army Chief of Staff. He was really focused on the blocking and tackling of manufacturing and making sure the country was producing enough tanks and airplanes. But FDR recognized as president there was something he could do too. So he went out, he traveled, he visited manufacturing plants like Boeing military up in Seattle. And when he went up, he brought a young pilot with him, a guy named Hewitt Wheelis. And he put Hewitt on the stage. He was a young Texan who had been when he was flying his plane, and the plane was just riddled with bullets, but miraculously he made it back to his base. And FDR had him stand in front of all these workers at Boeing and tell his story, and he, at the end of the story, he thanked them for building the plane at that plant that saved his life. And I would be willing to bet that, number one, there probably wasn't a dry eye in the house seeing this young, brave pilot thank them for the work they were doing. But it also, by doing that, he helped transform the way they thought about their work from being, you know, welders and riveters to really contributing to the war effort to fight for freedom in the world.
Oh.
So very powerful and wise move on FDR's part as a leader to really create that emotional connection with the workers, and it came from FDR's heart, too. You can't fake these things. They have to be genuine, and the great leaders have that.
That's so true. We're talking to Michael Lee Stollard, everybody, author of the book, The Connection Culture, A New Source of Competitive Advantage. All right, so second on the list is value, and you said earlier on that Steve Jobs didn't have that as a strength where you value other people, or at least he's certainly working on that. Talk to us about value and how that builds into the connection culture.
Well, we define value as when everyone in the culture, number one, they understand the needs of people. There's some intelligence about understanding people's human needs, that they're not just human doings, they're human beings. We're human beings, not machines. And number one, they appreciate their positive, unique contributions that everyone makes, whether they're the doorman like Nick at Sloan Kettering or the CEO of Sloan Kettering. And then finally, they also help them achieve their potential. So in this type of culture, which is increasingly rare, I'm sad to say, in America, you feel like you're surrounded by trusted friends who want to help you achieve your potential. And they want to see the team do their very best work rather than surrounded by competitors who want to hold you down because they want to advance up the corporate ladder. And it's very powerful. In fact, I would say of the three variables we're going to talk about today, the three elements of a connection culture, value, feeling valued as a human being, is the most important one in terms of the impact that it has on people.
All right. Now that's very interesting. You tell some great stories here, and we're going to be a little pressed for time, Mike, but tell the story about David Neeleman, who is the CEO of JetBlue, for people who don't recognize that
right.
name.
Well, he's no longer CEO of JetBlue. He's started a new aircraft company in company in Brazil. But when he started JetBlue back in 2000, Billy, he was, this was a hyper-competitive business, and he starts a brand new airline. One of the things he did was, well, let me just share a few things he did. He would go out and spend one day a week traveling on flights, cleaning up planes along with the crew, serving snacks and drinks, and throwing luggage with the luggage handlers. And he was out there working on the front lines and really sending a very powerful message that no job is beneath me as the CEO. And he was spending time, you know, he knew a lot of people's names. He got to know people. It was very powerful. He showed that he valued them as human beings. And he showed that he understood human needs, too, that people needed that connection. And they connected with him and inspired them to give their best efforts. Now, just a couple years later, in 2002, when JetBlue was growing by leaps and bounds, they needed to hire 2,000 people. They had 2,000 jobs to fill. And when they advertised, they were flooded with applications. In fact, they received 130,000 applications for 2,000 jobs.
Wow.
Now, do you think you could pick the best of the best from that applicant pool?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So, no surprise, people want to work for a company and a leader who they feel cares about them as people and wants to accomplish something great, which is part of what Neeleman did, too. He wanted to create a new airline where the people who work there connected with the passengers.
Well, without a doubt, we're talking to Mike Stollard, author of the book, The Connection Culture. And third on the list, Mike, is voice. And you use A.G. Lafley, who is the CEO of Procter & Gamble, as an example there. Talk to me about voice, and how does Lafley really embody that virtue, that characteristic?
Well, yeah, lots of good examples of voice. And Lafley, in recent years, is a great one. He came into Procter & Gamble in 2000 when the company was losing money. Half its brands were losing market share. It really was moving in the wrong direction. It was losing very talented people, too. And he implemented this element that we call voice. And voice exists in an organization when everyone seeks the ideas of others, they share ideas and opinions honestly, and they safeguard relational connections. Now, this is a culture that expresses humility, that leaders recognize they don't have all the answers. Nobody has a monopoly on good ideas. And so they tap the corporate mind, the corporate body, for ideas, and they're seeking ideas. Well, Lafley did that. When he became CEO, one of the first things he did was go out and visit with employees and customers and say, you know, tell me what's right, what's wrong, what's missing from what we're doing. And he implemented the best ideas, and within a year, you could see a turnaround in the attitudes of employees at P&G in terms of their confidence in Lafley as a leader and the direction of the company. And within 2 years, their stock price had increased 75%, and they were profitable and just on their way to a wildly successful tenure as a CEO at P&G. Now, he's retired from that position, but he just really turned around that company. It's because he connected with people, and he encouraged the values, in this particular case, the value of voice, we call it, in the culture, and it just rippled throughout P&G, and because of that, employees wanted to give their best efforts and align their behavior with organizational goals.
We're talking to Mike Stollard. Mike, the reason I chose Lafley as the example, the other thing that I liked about him, you said he tapped into the corporate minds. That is true. But he also tapped into minds outside of the corporation and set up one of the first open innovation platforms where engineers and scientists from around the world could submit ideas to P&G, and then they would select the best ideas and then turn them into products. Or if they ran into a problem, they would put it out on this open platform, and they would get solutions to the problems from the outside as well. A very open, and he allowed a lot of different voices. Mike, before I let you go, what do you want readers to take away from reading The Connection Culture?
Well, the important thing is I'd really encourage people to the Connection Culture piece you mentioned, that's actually a free download on my website. It's a short version of my book. The full version of the book is called Fired Up or Burned Out, but you can download the Connection Culture Manifesto on my website, which is michaelleestollard.com, or you can go to my book website, fireduporburnedout.com. Now, the important thing is to just understand that as a leader, most leaders understand they have to achieve task excellence. That's job one. But at the same time, if you're not intentional about creating a connection culture that achieves relationship excellence, then your success is not sustainable. You have to be intentional about developing both. That's the big picture. And the way you do it is by creating a culture of connection where people feel emotionally and rationally connected to you as a leader and to one another so that they want to give their best efforts and align their behavior with the group's goals. And when everybody is pulling hard in the same direction, great things happen.
And they do. We've been talking to Michael Lee Stollard, everybody, author of the book, The Connection Culture, and also Fired Up. Michael, thank you so much for being my special guest. We'll talk to you later.
Bill, it's my pleasure.